And I'm here at EBS, and with me is John Sullivan and Matt Dietrich and Bob Walton. And we're going to talk about EBS and rock and my manuscript and various things of that sort.
Might be worth just getting Jim Cavanaugh. He would see.
Okay, Bob is saying that the Jersey Cattle Club, Bob Cavanaugh, might be able to.
Jim
Cavanaugh might be able to find me. It now. It's a question of, do I really need that article? But it's fun to track these things down. That's part of the fun of research. There's the creative fun of writing, but then there's also the fun of doing all these other things. And so we could start right off with just a few questions, and then I'll listen to you men a lot. When did rock die? The Black Book is so unsatisfactory. I know that he did it in a hurry, and that he had a tremendous amount of material to cover. And I don't know how I would have organized it. I would have loved an index. But with all these things, we keep going back and coming up and going back and coming up in the different areas. And
well, the best way to find out is look at the picture out there.
It didn't say.
It didn't have the date of death on
no.
The picture.
It said dedicated in 1974 or something like that. Where's my black book? Here it is.
Well, I would guess it was 1972 or 1973.
I think it was 72. 72. I'm not sure, but it's long in there. I think the 2 years I would have picked 72, but I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm. We went to Europe in 72, and I remember. We were on our way for a family trip there at the time when this happened. And we were away, but that's why I would guess 72 as well, but I might have been off here.
Mm-hmm. And did Abby die before or after him?
After, yes.
After. And Abra is still there in Chicago, and I have her number and may call her, depending on, I mean, I don't know if I want to know how she's going to react to what I might say.
Rock's longtime secretary, she might be very helpful to
Ruth Highland, is that she, that was her maiden name. Communication with her.
But she'd be a very rich source of information and counsel. Is it H-Y? H-H-Y-L-A-N-D.
H-Y-L-A-N-D was her maiden name. But
mm-hmm. Well, I can probably track her down. I've done more since I sent those things, and I might just start reading something you haven't read that is now at the beginning of the last section, which is at this point the last section of ABS, the later years. And this will indicate to you the sort of thing I'm wondering about. Phil Higley was very open over the phone, and he said rock, you know, was extremely nasty when he was drunk, and he told me of the time when they managed to get him sobered up in time for some important meeting, and then he got a hold of a bottle after they got there, and the meeting was a disaster because he kept going over and over and over things. And I know how this is because my dad has become a late-in-life alcoholic. He wasn't all the time we were growing up, and at this point, well, for several years now, we've rationed him so that he gets, you know, a certain amount a day, and he gets a bit cross about that once in a while, but, you know, it's kept him livable with us and all, and I suspect it has a lot to do with, genes, of course, but also with having one's life work come to an end. And here's the beginning of the fourth section that has to do with cows and breeding. And this is the last big section. When they told me at Northwestern, how much do you have to do? I said, I have two big sections and they're the hardest. And one is the whole hybrid seed corn. I said, I've got loads of material on it, but I've not put it together. And the other is the artificial insemination and the cow breeding and all that. And I got the corn done. That drew me to a halt several times over the years, but I've had two men at the University of Wisconsin and at Illinois who've been giving me good advice on that. And by the way, I think our state vet, and he and I have become very good friends because he's retired and he went to school in Kansas with Dick Nylans, and Dr. Nylans was down, the vet down in Janesville. And so he's been giving me, because I wanted 1945 medicine, veterinarian medicine. And Paul Dobie is our state vet. And so I've gotten to know him and we're good friends. And he told me he had a close friend up here outside of Madison. And I would guess that would be Dave Bartlett. The name keeps coming to me, and as soon as I get back to Springfield, I'll call Paul and say, you know, was the person I didn't get in touch with on the vet stuff, Dave Bartlett, and I think he'll say yes. Anyway, here's the way this now begins. Besides setting up the Wisconsin Scientific Breeding Institute and other studs, Rock Prentice in 1948 establishes the American Foundation for the Study of Genetics. Its research laboratories are located with WSBI. Daddy is invited to be on that board of directors too. Jackie is a sophomore at Beloit College. She is living at home and hears immediately the circumstances of the invitation. Daddy is at the Prentice's Lake Geneva home for a WSBI directors meeting, a dinner with wives present. Both he and Rock drink far too much at the meal and on into the evening. Quite late at night, Daddy says something that offends Rock. Rock squares off, raises an arm before him. Daddy is afraid he's about to receive a punch in the face. He figures he deserves it. Instead, Rock declares, "I snap your nose, sir," and proceeds to give Daddy's nose a resounding snap with his thumb and middle finger. Daddy rears back, bridles in turn, replies, "I snap your nose, sir," and returns just as hard a snap. Before the fight can progress to further outrages, the other directors separate them. Shortly thereafter, Daddy goes into the bathroom. Rock follows him in. "Ron," he says, "I want you to serve on the board of my American Foundation for the Study of Genetics." Daddy pauses. "Rock," he finally says, "given the state we're both in, I think it'd be better if you consider your offer and be sure you want to make it. Call me in a couple of days, and if you still want me to be on the board, I'll certainly think about it." Mother, who drives Daddy home, is mortified. I think I've got to fix that a little, because I think she was mortified at his being drunk. She was pleased at the invitation for him to be on the board. And I think that she was also amused at the fight. So I need to do that. And then I stick in something I may take out, because it's sort of tangential. Jackie has never known Daddy to be drunk before. She remembers vividly the first time she's learned he's even taken a drink. Actually, she has three strong memories of that occasion. She's 8 or 9, and the family is driving north above Madison to visit friends at their cottage on Portage Lake. She's found in the car a metal whistle with a plunger. It's called a slush pump. And by sliding the plunger up and down, she can make very wonderful sliding whistles. Then she begins to experiment, to move the plunger carefully from spot to spot, making tunes. She is totally entranced. It is one of those rare in life periods of absolute bliss. Then Mother says, "Jackie, stop that noise. It's bothering everybody." Jackie stops. She holds the unusable slush pump in her lap. The ride has turned into absolute misery, but it gets worse. Daddy isn't sure of the way and stops at a tavern to ask directions. When he returns to the car, he says, "I had a beer while I was in there. You shouldn't just stop for information." Jackie's shock is palpable. Grandma, Grandpa, everybody knows that beer drinking is one of the greatest of evils. She hears it in Sunday school regularly, and now her own father has had a beer. That night, in a lumpy bed in a strange cottage, she lies awake, tossing and turning. She finally sleeps. In the morning, she's repulsed to discover she's shared her bed with a now dismembered Daddy Longlegs. Rock Prentice calls in a few days. He repeats his offer, and Daddy accepts. He becomes secretary of the American Foundation for the Study of Genetics. The geneticist, Dr. Elwin Willett, is the manager. And then I go on talking about OVA.
Okay, he's not a geneticist.
The book said he was a geneticist.
He isn't.
What is he?
He's a physiologist. I sure missed that when I proofread this, Matthew Kay's.
Either that or I've got it in other notes, but I've used that book a lot, and that's another question I need to ask. I've combined the information in the book with my own information and the oral history I've had from people, and I'm wondering what sort of permissions I need to use what's in Bushner's book.
Second appointment was announced September 1, the same day Harlan Cook was hired. Dr. Elwin Willett was named Director of Research. Dr. Willett received his PhD from Cornell in 1941 and spent the intervening years in Puerto Rico at the experiment station at the University of Hawaii as an associate professor of agriculture.
Okay.
It's actually a reproductive physiologist.
Okay, well, I got geneticists somewhere, but I don't know where. That's one of my research flaws, is I don't take down always where I get my information. And then you see later in this chapter, when I finished talking about Lue, and that's where it ended for the two of you. The WSBI Board of Directors is in place until 1958. I'm just reading here, so I'll turn this off for a second. We're talking about when ABS became incorporated.
It was about 1961, wasn't it?
No, it was after I came there.
It was?
It was in 1963 or something. It was called ABS, but I think it became a member of the newsletter and became incorporated. I don't know what
that was. It was incorporated when I came in 63.
Yeah. It was much before 63.
Yeah.
I was
still in Chicago yet.
Mm-hmm. Maybe it was the spring of 63 then. Because I remember I was there and then the newsletters came out. The point being is maybe would all these other pieces perhaps been cleaned up at the time ABF became incorporated?
I would think that would be the time, because when I became involved with ACFR, as we used to call it, ACFR, A-N-D-R, in 63, right away, and I don't remember a board. It was Bouet's deal. And he, at that point in time, he was planning on its, you know, its continuation after he left the scene. And that's when Merriman came in, the man, Commodore Merriman.
Well, Dad doesn't remember, and I haven't been able to find any details on what happened to the research. I mean, did it continue? Is it still going on?
Oh, no, it's gone.
Because one thing in the book says the first 25 years was research, and the second 25 years was expansion
different,
and
different kind of research,
different sort of stuff.
I've got to make one phone call.
Okay.
No, what happened is, and I don't have all the dates, but I know in 63, the way he was heading it up, and at that point in time, it was totally separated from ABS.
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't getting any more money from anybody. And Rock's mother, who died around that time, left $1 million endowment to the foundation. And that was it.
Mm-hmm.
And the rest had to be on their own. And I remember Lue sort of scrounging around to make sure that the institute could continue.
Mm-hmm.
And he was planning on his successor.
Mm-hmm.
And then Lue died, and this Merriman, Commander Merriman, used to be associated with the Navy Department in Beltsville. And was doing their work on cryobiology. And he moved it to Maryland. And this would have been the early 70s. The cryobiology has a history of the way you would have that. Cryobiology is a journal on low temperatures and was founded by the way. I can go downstairs mm-hmm. and pick that out.
Well, I asked Steve Yon over the phone before, well, last month or something, when I had various questions. I said, the book gives only this much space to Lue. I said, was that because he wasn't very important, or because there wasn't room in the book, or you know, because I said, I've got various materials on that. He said, oh no, he was very important. He said he thought it was more of a ladder, that the book just couldn't go into everything. And,
Right, and Louet was a theoretical researcher. He wanted to understand how ice is formed, for instance, and different speeds of dropping the temperature, what kind of ice crystals form. So his contribution to ABS was nothing. It was Elwin Willett, when he head up the research arm. And so when this separation came, that's when Elliot sort of then headed up ABS research.
Uh-huh.
And Louet, then after he died, Commander Perry sold the place. And he moved AFRA.
Commander Perry?
Yeah.
Or Merriman?
It's Perry. The contemporaries.
Okay.
It's Perry. He moved the name, the money, to Merriman.
Mm-hmm.
And all the staff that he had, the top staff, all left.
Well, then Louet did a lot of fundamental research, but it was not helpful to the...
It wasn't very applied.
It wasn't very applied, yeah. Well, of course, I've got a quotation in here, that last quotation I have of what you two men have read, where Louet says that he doesn't care if it... Where is it? I am pleased, of course, when some of my studies have practical use, but I hold the view that the findings which procure material comfort to fellow men, even those which relieve human suffering, are not comparable as social accomplishments to those which bring satisfaction to the spiritual aspirations of man in his pursuit of truth. So he was a man in pursuit of truth, and if it happened to fall out that it helped ABS, fine.
Right. And it was old Europe type.
Old Europe.
For instance, every major staff person, and when I was there, we were doing a special project with that for ABS.
This is John Sullivan talking, by the way.
Okay. At the end of the day, everybody had a report to go into his office, sit down, and tell him what they did for the day.
Mm-hmm.
Every day.
He kind of did his own thing, didn't he? He kind of did his own thing there.
Yeah.
I really never knew him, so I'm glad for you to be here.
He's a wonderful man. I don't know, did you...
Yeah, Phil said he was a brilliant man.
Oh, yeah. But one of the stories I heard in order for Rock... He wrote a book, Life and Death at Low Temperatures, which was a really... You know, for its time, it really was a magnificent piece of work.
Yeah, it's mentioned here.
And
go on.
He wrote it...
The author of Life and Death at Low Temperatures.
He was actually a co-author. There was another author, Gihinio, and it was a nun who really did the writing out of it, both. And Gehenio, something like that. I had to look it up.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a wonderful title for the book.
Yeah, well, I can't and don't want to tell the entire history of everything because I can't.
Right.
It would make it far too. It's already far too long a book. But
well, the foundation of the building, Buckeye Road, is eventually bought by Agrigenetics, which is the biotech firm, which is now and did a tremendous amount of remodeling, and now they were bought by Mycogen, another biotech.
Mm-hmm.
I think the introduction, you were that of Olivier to the industry. Bach had seen, maybe read the book,
I think it was.
And so he invited him to Chicago, their office, for a symposium, including representatives of the competition that were interested in other people seeing them at the time. And of course, when he, I think he called him on the phone, and when he approached him, the possibility of he could come, and of course, artificial insemination, all that he had been in association with was the possibility of artificial insemination in humans. And of course, he was immediately, he was no idea what it was. And Rock explained to him what it was, this was a livestock. And I don't know how long it took to convince him that to come and meet with the group, but he did. And it was a wonderful presentation that he made there at that time. And that was when he explained, I think, one of the things here I was going to discuss the matter of how the visceral assisted in the preservation of the scene. I was very impressed at the time as to what his ability was as a teacher and instructor, how he could at least represent his mother. Several of them were scientists, but a lot of them weren't, you know, and he could talk to them on their level. And that was further explained to me when I, son was, I suppose, 12 or 13, he and Brenda did. We came up here to visit one weekend, went over to the foundation, and Father Begay was there, went in his office. And he started to talk to those boys about scientific things in a language that they could understand. On another occasion, came up here with a friend of mine, and there was two Mexican nuns with us in the middle there. And when it's in his office, and before he started the conversation, he says, "What is your education?" Nuns. And specifically so he can talk to them on the level that they understand. I think that was one of his he had it. He could talk to you on level, regardless of what your level was. And so that what contribution I think there was at that time. And then following that, here that thing, following summer, he and his staff came here to Madison and done some work. Now, I don't remember what that project was, but Rock had him come before he was hired to move up here. And whether that was a specific project that was useful to ABS at the time or not, I'm not sure. And he was here for the summer.
When did he come?
Lié?
Yes.
He came when it changed from when Willett left. It would have been 58.
So
wouldn't it?
So ABS had already made the conversion to frozen semen in the field.
Yes.
So really much of that work had been achieved, and he probably pursued more in things, but maybe weren't necessarily what ABS was doing.
That's right.
And probably a lot much of the work that applied for ABS was done at ABS Labs by Irv and his team.
Right.
I think that's probably what happened.
One of the stories I heard, I don't know if it's true, that I thought about when I was driving down here this morning. One of the ways, apparently the way was very reluctant to come to head up the institute. Mm-hmm. But one of the ways that Rock induced it was to buy a house on Lake Monona.
I've got that in there.
With
an observatory,
okay.
A telescope on there. He lured him away from St. Louis. Money wouldn't really do it because the money went to his order.
That's right.
But the perks did it. So I've got that in because those are stories that I grew up with. I knew those stories. But one more then about how I'm, at the moment, how I'm ending up with Rock. Jackie, after saying the board of directors is in place till 58 when it's dissolved, merges with ABS, but Daddy is on the board of the Foundation for Biological Research through whatever. Jackie knows a few more stories over the years connected with Rock Prentice and his family. She is in on some of them. She's a junior in high school when the family shares Thanksgiving dinner with the Prentices at their home on the shores of Lake Geneva. The Dogans supply a suckling pig from the farm, and the Prentices prepare it. It comes to the table on a large platter. It's brown and crisp, surrounded with attractive garnishes, and its fragrance primes the springs of every salivary gland. But it lies with its little legs tucked under it, its curly tail still in place, olives in its eye sockets, green with pimento pupils, and a red crab apple in its stretched jaws. Jackie feels a wrench, seeing in Pamplemousse, behind the roasted delicacy, the living piglet, which was scampering around so happily only a day or two ago. Yet she doesn't let that prevent her from savoring the dinner. The pork is so tender that it falls off the bones. Afterwards, Jackie hikes all around the grounds with the Prentice daughter, Abra, who is perhaps seven, and entertains her with stories of her various pets. Brock Prentice discovers she is studying Latin and tells her about his childhood Latin studies and that his father had books translated into Latin for him and his sibling, for him and his siblings to read. He makes her a present of one of the volumes of the Mount Hope Classics and signs it Mocte Petrelli, Little Rock. She treasures it all her life. When she is married in 1950, probably the loveliest wedding present she and her husband receive is a set of 12 gold-rimmed dessert plates, each with an exquisite painting of a different fruit. She treasures these all her life, too. She and her husband visit Mount Hope. They are on their way to Vermont, the summer of 51, and with youthful brashness decide to make a call on Rock's parents. You know, whatever prompted us. Jackie is, of course, familiar with E. Parmalee Prentice's views and his influence on her family. She has also read two of his books, Farming for Famine and Hunger in History. She and her husband are traveling in a 1932 Model A Ford and have been camping out. When they get close to the estate, winding their way along a wooded gravel road in western Massachusetts, they stop at a mountain stream, scrub themselves, and change into their good clothes. They then drive through the gates and grounds and up to the front of the imposing mansion. The view is a breathtaking one out over the blue Berkshires. They haven't called ahead, but E. Parmalee Prentice, an elderly gentleman, greets them graciously, introduces them to his wife, shows them around his barns, talks poultry breeding, and gives them a copy of his book, The Mount Hope Golden Egg. They are served refreshments in an arbor and then resume their journey. Several years later, Daddy shows Jackie, and I took this out of the book, although I'm sure we have one, shows Jackie a handsome booklet that Rock Prentice has recently published, How ABS Protects the Health of Your Herd. Inside, he has inscribed, "For this I received the only compliment I have ever received from my father." And Rock's leadership of ABS over the years is dedicated, brilliant, visionary, and hardworking to the state of exhaustion. He goes after the very best people he can find in every field and wins them to ABS. Yet his alcoholism, no secret to his family and all his associates and covered for as best they can, plays havoc with his health and often with his work. The best period ABS ever has, one of his associates says, and this is Phil, is when his wife bets Rock that he can't go for a year without a drink. He wins the bet, but the day after the assigned time, he disappears on a two-month bender. His staff carries on without him. Daddy is in on one of these events. One mid-afternoon, Rock shows up unexpectedly at Chez Nous. Daddy has no idea how he gets there. Rock doesn't know either. He is totally soused. Daddy gets into bed, then calls the bull stud. "Thank God you found him," says Phil Higley fervently. "He's supposed to be giving a speech at 6 o'clock. Keep him asleep or full of coffee and we'll be right down." Daddy and mother keep guard until Rock's staff fetches him. Late in 1960, Rock Prentice suffers a stroke. His left side is paralyzed. The book doesn't say. It just says he's disabled, but I had heard it was his left side was paralyzed. He can neither walk nor talk. This I got out of the book. He immediately teaches himself Morse code so that if he does not recover his speech, he can communicate by blinking. His daughter is going to be married the following, I need to get that date, and he is determined to walk down the aisle with her. He gets up at 4 every morning, goes through physical therapy, practices tongue twisters. He teaches himself to walk and talk again. His first public speech is in the spring of 1961 at a 20-year celebration of ABS in Madison at the Lorraine Hotel. 350 staff and distinguished guests attend. Father Lee gives the invocation. P.I. Higley introduces the guests. R.A. gives the response. And it was a speech, I think. And I've got it somewhere, but I haven't been able to find it yet. and Rock Prentice's acknowledgement closes the program. A month later, and this is all conjecture, the dates, is Abra's wedding, because the book says it's her coming out, but Mother and Daddy wouldn't have been invited to Abra's coming out, but they were invited to the wedding. So I need to find when the wedding is, and I can skip the coming out if that's there too. A month later is Abra's wedding. Daddy and Mother are there. Abra is a radiant bride. She walks down the aisle on the arm of her father. Daddy says that he and Mother were holding their breaths, praying that Rock would make it without falling. Everyone was. But Rock makes it and gives Abra away. Later, he dances with her at the reception. It is a beautiful and happy wedding and a triumph to Rock's determination. And then I haven't got anything now for the ending. And whatever the history is after that. But those are the sort of things that I've put in about Rock's problems. And they make for interesting reading, I think. And they have to do with my family. And I'm wondering how gently I need to tread.
That was a problem with Fred when he was writing it.
He's got stuff in there.
He says, I think it's got to be in there because that's part of it. He was denying it. People knew it.
In fact, the weakness I thought of this.
And the fact that he could go on and accomplish what he did,
yeah.
Even with that kind of affliction, I think is what has to be.
And I also intend to put in what this book has, but what we've always said too, which is that he, you know, looked on his fortune as a trust, and he used it for good, unlike many another fortune. The Dodge Millions, for instance, were dissipated in billions or whatever they were.
I would think if you have every right to weave in as you have, and just be sure that the part of the message comes across that he did achieve despite that.
Yeah.
I think that's the important part. And if you do that, I don't think anybody's going to have any question at all.
Well, good, because I think, I mean, the accounts are mostly accounts, but when I do have stories and things, I put them in. I mean, none of those would make a separate story. I wouldn't want a whole separate story just on how he
drank.
How Dad came to be on the board of the Foundation for Biological Research. And most of this chapter will be other things having to do with the progress of ABS.
Now, do you have in there how your father and Rock got together?
Yes.
Okay.
I
don't know that.
Matt and Bob know that, which is that the first section of the book is, of the ABS stuff, I'm calling the Mount Hope Index. And when Dad was in 1927, the year before I was born, Dad read in this Jersey Breeders Journal, or whatever it was called then, an article by E. Parmalee Prentice and about indexing bulls. And Dad was very excited, and we had kept records, he and Grandpa, ever since 1915. And so he spent most of the winter charting out all of his cows and the bulls and things like that. And proved to his satisfaction that what Prentice was saying was true. And so he wrote Prentice and told him what he'd been doing with his own herd and how he had discovered which bulls were good and which ones weren't and which were just so-so, which weren't improving the herd. And he and Prentice struck up a correspondence, and Prentice sent him two bulls, young bulls, to get a record on them, I guess is what the term is. And so when Rock showed up in Chicago and Barrington and Elgin, why, there was already the contact between Parmalee Prentice and my dad. And so, and meanwhile, then the second section that I sent these two men is mainly on the Rock County Breeders Co-op, which was the second in the country. It came into existence a couple of months after New Jersey. And we immediately began using the Prentice semen just as soon as it was available. I'm not sure while it was still at Barrington, but certainly by the time it was at Elgin, it was being flown up in a little plane, and the co-op gave up its Guernsey bulls. And as soon as they got up here to Madison and expanded to other bulls, why they gave up all their bulls. And so they were right in the middle of this academic fight with the university and Dean Froker and Rich Man's Hobby and all that sort of thing, which I'm trying, and I need to say a little more about that, because this book indicates and all too that there was a certain amount of tension between private enterprise and research and academic research all along the way, or for a long time, with ABS being out ahead.
Still is.
And still is, good.
The battle goes on.
The battle is still going on? Okay, it hasn't. I mean, the universities, and I'm part of a university, and I've certainly been exposed to universities all my life. I mean, what, they've got an arrogance about their right to do this sort of thing, and yet I realize that there are other research labs that aren't university connected. Isn't Bell Labs? That's not university connected, is it? And the science magazines I read, I talk, the Livermore Labs and things like that. Those
that's government.
Is that? That's
federal,
government.
The federal government.
Yeah, well, government and universities seem to think that, that they're the ones that that can do the research. And yet here's ABS that was way ahead of everybody else long before.
Back to your discussion on Rock there as to what recovery from stroke. I think he finally got to the place where he's even playing tennis. And I'm all happy, but then I think after they moved to Arizona, I think he got to the place where he could play some tennis. Whether that's something you want to show, but I mean, he not only walked down the aisle with his daughter, his determination, he got
yeah.
to place where he played some tennis.
But I gathered from the book and also from the fact that I ceased hearing stories that Rock sort of gradually pulled out, or that after the stroke, that he wasn't the big boss in the sense that he'd been before. Didn't Phil Higley become president at that point, or he'd already been?
Yeah, he became president, I think, when it became a corporation in 1963.
Yeah.
I think he was general manager, I believe. So
mm-hmm.
I think, and then I don't know if he was a president then, but you know more than I know.
Yeah, he was president.
Mm-hmm. I've got that date in there.
That's what I'm asking. At that point,
prior to that, he was general manager.
Right, that's what I meant. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So he was the first president, you were the second, and you were the third.
Yes.
Are you still president?
No.
Who's president now, or isn't there one?
Jack Shelton.
Jack Shelton now. I've got this on tape, so I don't need to write things down. But was he the fourth president, or was there
yes.
somebody?
No.
Mm-hmm. Are you retired now?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Phil Higley told me the story that's also in there about he was the one where in 64 or wherever it was when or maybe it was you, Bob. This is why I need a well, I'll mention it. I'll tell you the story, and it's in here somewhere. Where either Phil or you said you would be president if you had free rein to do what you wanted. And Rock said, all right. And then they did this, what Rock considered sellout to the breed associations by doing something with the bulls he came storming in. And he said the whole place ought to be plowed under or something like that. The term is in there somewhere else. And was furious.
No.
And then he turned on his heel and marched out and never said another word about it. And did not, you know. Was that you or was that Phil?
No, that was Phil.
That was Phil. Okay.
Maybe I can pick up the story a little bit just for seeing what led to that. And so you'll have.
It was a marketing thing, wasn't
yes.
it?
Well, that and you know the book Utilities Beauty that he wrote?
I haven't seen it yet. I'm wondering where I can find a copy.
Where we can lay a hand on. But there had been a battle that went on for from
the Mount Hope, or American Index Days even. And where, I think, I shouldn't judge because I wasn't there, but I think it became a more of a philosophical academic battle than it was the real world battle, but Rock and ABS at that time, but really led by Rock, were believed that the breed associations were misleading the industry and paying too much attention to what he called type. And he believed he should only pay attention to production. So they each built up a case that was not real, but they had a battle that went on that just separated them by a huge chasm. And that's what led to many of those early problems, differences, that led to his, after he recovered from stroke, he determined he was going to write this book that laid all this out about utility, and he called it Utility is Beauty. It's a beautifully written book.
Oh, yeah.
But you have to know about it in the context of the previous battles, because if you were opposed to him, you didn't read the book with any thought at all about what he was really saying.
Right.
And if you read into what was going on, you realize what he was saying in the book had already been achieved. You know, the battle was long since won. But he was determined, that last battle, and that...
He was going to hammer it down.
That's right. And that and the customers didn't understand this. The customers were very vulnerable to somebody that would say, we're going to give you all things. And Curtis Breeding Service, you know who they were.
Yeah.
Curtis Candy Company. Were coming on a scene and beginning bigger. And so when Rock published this Utility Beauty, they took full advantage of that. And they began growing quite rapidly because they were picking up many of our customers out there, because we would not give them, or ABS preached this philosophy that we're not going to give you any information about type, because Rock was like his father, he was a dictator. I know what is best for you, and I'll be damned if I'm not going to, I'm going to see to it you get what I think you should have. I mean, he didn't understand that the world didn't really quite work that way. And so that led to Utility Beauty and the battle that came from that, and the problems with our marketing group and their being losing market to people because of this. And that's when, and I'll have to back up again a little bit later, but I had already come to ABS, and I contributed probably to that.
Because as I recall, it was 64 when Utility was Beauty, and you came in 63.
Yeah, 62.
62.
So anyway, I contributed, I guess, to the problem that Phil and Rock got into the fight about. Anyway, I'll come back to pick that up, but
all right.
Finish this piece off. Then Rock, Phil said, you know, we've got to, and many of us were working with him to say, you know, the battle has been won, we're just hurting ourselves now. We're shooting ourselves in the foot with carrying on this battle about defending Utility of Beauty. When what I came to do, we're already doing all of that. We've solved that problem. And we need to publish because people want to know information. And Phil said, we will do that. We will publish the type information on our bulls and on the daughters of our bulls. And that's what, then Rock came in and said, and blew his sack and led to, and I didn't know at the time, but it was so that it was quite that bitter between Rock and Phil at that moment, you know, that it was such a tough situation for Phil. But he stood the barrage and stood his ground, and we went on from there. And Rock, and if I can jump on ahead about 7 years later, when Rock had moved to and sold a company, he had moved to Arizona, and I think it was 1971, and the first major USDA sergeant made, not the first one, but a major one came out. And I was in Arizona for another purpose. I went over to see him, and I had this new summary of all the bulls, and we could show how in this new whole system, the ABS bulls, we just were dominating the whole industry. And was able to go to Rock and show him all this and explain to him, and I think in the way he understood, that we had not sold him down the river. We had, in fact, had put into practice the ideas that he had been doing. And so I think I felt that he, at that point, knew that it had been a success, that we didn't in fact sell him down the river on his principles. We really got on with what you have to do to make it work. Well, if I can back up a little bit, maybe, because in the 50s, late 50s, it became obvious to people studying it, and I think ABS studied it, USDA's for that information, that despite all the hard work and all the studies and the American Index and the other systems and all the work on spreading the semen wider for more great bulls and the selection, that there'd hardly been any change at all in the genetic value of our population in this country, despite all that work. And that was a real shocker to everybody who worked at it. And it was a real shocker to Rock Prentice to think, you know, we've done all this, and yet they really haven't improved much. They're basically the same as they were before we did all this. And if we're going to do something, we better do it right. So then he consulted with some geneticists, and they had some ideas were coming along. And they said, well, we must do it a different way. We must come to grips with it. And that's when they made a search, and I was the lucky winner of that search to come to EBS as a geneticist. And I was the first professional geneticist hired by an AI company. And I came to set up. And I made a copy for you here of the paper that I then later distributed in 1963. It explained the whole program that I came to ABS to outline. So I'd put much of it into practice there, but this was about a year later when this was published, and then maybe 100,000 copies of this over the next several years went out to all of our customers and our associated herds and our staff, and it explained the genetic principles, explained how we're going to do the program.
Okay, now let me ask a question at this point. The book here talks about you're introducing a progeny test and about the initials, let's see, estimated daughter superiority. The progeny test phrase was used a lot earlier. And I have two big sets. I mean, I have the Lue set, but this was a series of articles in the Beloit Daily News on the Rock County Breeders Co-op, but also on ABS and the whole genetic business. And it talks about the progeny test, by which they mean daughter dam. What is the difference?
Okay.
I mean, do they use the same term for both of these?
Yes, in a way. And
but it's a different thing.
Yeah. Well, first, and this is what this is about. It just explains the genetic principles, and it comes down here to we call it predicted. I guess later we call it estimated daughter superiority. We call it EDS for fun. But and this was the formula I introduced. So it was a different way, first of all, of evaluating. So it took into account not only the daughters and the dams, but it took into account the herd mates of the daughters and the herd mates of the dams as a means of separating the genetic part from the environmental part. And you touched on that earlier in your writings, that why the American Index misled them, because if they changed how they fed them, then the daughters...
Or how often they milked them.
But whatever they did. Uh-huh. But between the time the daughters... the dams produced and the daughters produced,
mm-hmm.
And you changed the environment, made it better, and then you doubled the difference between the two. You were doubling not a genetic difference, but an environmental difference, and that's why they got misled so much. So first of all, it was a different system for evaluating to sort out the true genetic differences, and so that's what I introduced here, and then I put in a note here for you. This later became, 2 years later, was adopted by the USDA, and they named it predicted difference. And it basically is still the same system that's used all over the world now.
Mm-hmm.
So ABS pioneered that.
ABS pioneered that.
No. it has different names now, but it's and with new computers, there are more things you can do that we outlined were the things that need to be done, but we
mm-hmm.
did that. And so that outlined. So then that was, first of all, how you evaluate them and to cut through the environmental differences and the genetic differences. Because you only can put the genetic differences in that little bottle mm-hmm. of semen. Then the other part that was different is we then used this to create better bulls. We didn't just wait till somebody came to the bull and said, here's a bull, are you evaluating? This is what his daughters did. We began to use it to create a new line of bulls. We would find the best cows in the country using our systems. We would arrange a contract to have that cow bred to a bull that we had evaluated that we knew from the test of time was an outstanding bull.
Mm-hmm.
Before that, these kind of cows and bulls never met.
Mm-hmm.
There was never a marriage. And so our source of genetic improvement was always limited. So we created a whole new source of...
It was just the sending the high class, the high index semen to the cows, rather than saying, here is a tremendously superior cow, we will now use her to breed a bull.
That's right. So we went out and created...
Okay, because the idea up until then was we'll use our superior cows to create more cows.
Yes.
The whole ovotransplant was let's get more heifers out of these. Okay. All right.
So what we did was create a better system for evaluation. Mm-hmm. Then we put that into practice to create a new generation of bulls. And I think maybe where I'll have it, but there's a chart somewhere here that shows this chart shows the in a fairly optimum situation the amount of genetic improvement will come from these different sources. Now these are the grandparents of a bull you're going to have.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to start thinking, you know, ahead, or you've got to plan ahead in order to achieve this. So these are the four sources, and you see that the top half is the father of the bull and the mother of the bull, and there is those two that add up to 76% of the improvement that you're going to get that's going to come from doing something about that.
Mm-hmm.
And in the next one, and this is what you get the third one after your progeny test, and you sort among those. And in this one, is that's all you're going to get from what they've been doing. So you had to harness this genetic power, and that's what we really did with the ABIS progeny testing program. And the whole world has copied this whole system now, but that's what really was involved.
Okay, well,
and
I'll study that out.
Some of it gives examples. But the part in between here really had to do with the battle on the type, and I touched on that a bit, so I did a major study to show that.
Well, let me ask a question then of a story that I might mention because it's colorful. Was the Canadian bull that had the big party at the Lorraine Hotel a bull that by this was supposed to be good? Because if he hadn't gone through the five daughters and all this sort of thing,
no.
How did he get to be at the Lorraine Hotel?
Okay. Well,
and then turn out to be a dud.
His name was Emperor.
Yeah, I've got the. I stopped. Yeah. Well, it took me a while, but I managed. And, you know, certain ABS events didn't get written up in the Madison papers. I was there Tuesday, and I did get the one that was in the back here, where it describes all this fanfare and ermine capes and things like that, which would be sort of fun.
Well, his father was a bull called ABC Reflecting Sovereign, who had been a very, very famous bull in Canada.
ABC what?
Reflection Sovereign.
I think they have that down there,
yes.
Too. I love these bull names.
And he had been dead for 12 years, but he had...
this is all getting done.
Some frozen semen in there.
Uh-huh.
And so we had been working with a breeder in Canada who had quite an outstanding cow, and he'd bred that cow to this ABC Perfection Sovereign, and there was a bull calf there.
Mm-hmm.
And and at that point, we didn't have that much information on the Canadian bulls.
Mm-hmm.
ABC was a very famous bull, a very saleable bull, so we thought, well, we'll take a chance on this, and we'll put him in the system. Now, subsequently, we, of course, found out that he, and after that, we didn't sample any Canadian bulls for many years, because that would clearly show that their population was way behind our population genetically. And it was a waste of time to spend on it. But we didn't know that at the time.
Mm-hmm.
We took a shot on him, and once we did it, and first they had a big party, going away party for him in Canada. That's where we got the idea. Well, we'll have to do something like that to have a big do here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
they escorted him all the way to the border with Canadian Mounties,
right.
I understand.
And so that's what led then to, first of all, he had to go through quarantine. And when he came out of quarantine, then we had the party for him.
The party was as much a publicity thing, wasn't it, to inform the public about ABS and about genetic testing?
And there were two things happened about that time. I don't know whether you came across the Don Auger bulls in any of your stories.
Yeah, there was a huge sale that tells about here, and fantastic amount
anyway,
of money.
We were about to graduate. ABS had been, let's see, this. We were in the process of being sold, I guess, then. But we'd had the crunch basically I was asked to become responsible for running ABS
mm-hmm.
about 1965, when it almost went belly up,
mm-hmm.
Just almost finished. And there were meetings in Chicago for some time between with Rock and Phil and Bob Elsif, the financial Blackman and Dave Bartlett. And they were meeting really to talk about an orderly liquidation, because the buildup of all of these problems on the type and everything else, and the market loss of the market share, and other mistakes that are being made in the marketing, which actually I wrote, I should have got some of those letters for you, I guess, too. But I wrote a letter in 1964 to the staff. Let me back up a minute more. When I left, was brought to EBS from the University of Kentucky, one of the things my friends said, don't think about it, don't go to EBS, because it was not only Wisconsin didn't like Rock Prentice, but every dean and every department head all over the United States did not like Rock Prentice. They all felt he was hurting their little co-op. Mm-hmm. So my chairman at Kentucky said, I wouldn't even bother to answer the letter that I'd received from EBS, but I went anyway. Anyway, then when I did come, my friends wrote me off. I'd crossed the line into the commercial world. I was forever tainted. I could never come back to the research and academic world, because now I was dirty. I had entered the commercial world. So I had to succeed. Then, in my early years with ABS, I was out in the field everywhere, finding these cows, working with reps, setting up this program. And so I actually probably knew more about the company than anybody, as it turned out, because I was out there in the field, and I could see the problems, I could see the marketing problems, and what our people were struggling with. And I wrote a letter to Bill Higley and the executive committee. I think, were you on the executive committee then? And it was really in defense, because I said to myself, if this company doesn't, if it fails before I finish 5 years, one generation, they have just wiped out my career.
Right.
I cannot go back.
You can't get back into academia.
So I wrote it in self-defense, saying these are some of the things, actually five things, this is what you need to do. And they, fortunately or unfortunately for me, they didn't pay any attention then. That was in, I think, August of 1964. And then we were moved here in August of 65, I think.
By here, you mean to DeForest?
DeForest. Moved to that building. This is all new, this side, about 5 years. That was a building that Rock originally built there, that half of it.
Mm-hmm.
We moved into that, in this new facility, and we were on a fiscal year that ended in September 30th, and the only kind of counted things up at the end of the quarter. The computers and all that weren't so big then. So at the end of September, they counted up, and whoa and behold, they lost so much money you can't believe. I mean, it was, and the millions of dollars that Rock had put in as a sort of a trust to pay for my program to get through that phylogeny testing program to graduate the first crop was almost all gone, because it had been dumped into this marketing abyss, this loss that was just down the tube, because marketing share was going down so much. And so then they began.
And his book at that time hadn't helped anything.
No, that's
which
right.
Had come out, and
it was still part of the problem.
Yeah.
So they began meeting then in Chicago, where Rock lived. They'd go down there, and I was actually up in Canada.
Now, by they, you mean Phil Higley, and
Rock,
Bartlett.
Bartlett and Elsus.
And Elsus.
And talking about an orderly liquidation. Rock always thinks everything should be orderly.
Mm-hmm.
So if a liquidation was going to happen, it was going to be an orderly liquidation. So that, according to what Rock or Phil told me, that was much of what they talked about in those several meetings they had down there. And then I was up in Brandon, Vermont, Manitoba, for a meeting up there, and I had a call from Phil. Would I come right back as quick as I could and meet with him in Chicago? Because they finally thought about the letter I'd written to him, and they said, well, maybe we ought to listen to this guy. So I remember
flying down,
coming across icy roads from Brandon to Winnipeg, uh-huh, flying overnight in a little plane, and finally getting to Chicago and meeting them in Chicago, and hearing then, first time, as I really quite knew, because nobody, I was just a junior executive then,
uh-huh,
how bad the problem was, and that there was, I think there was $233,000 left in the kitty of
not
the
much.
Millions of dollars that he had put in to see this through. I mean, it was near bankruptcy.
Mm-hmm.
And so, for whatever reason, I stood by my guns, saying, "This is what we need to do." Now you must edit this, so I'll tell you the truth.
Well, I'll try to.
I'll tell you the truth, but you need to edit it for the benefit of. We don't want to hurt anybody else.
Yeah, I'll edit it, and I will have you men read it before.
Anyway,
Northwestern
Phil,
edits it.
Phil wanted to he thought he should, since he was the president, he should take the lead and take over the marketing responsibility, because marketing is where it really got in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
But I knew that really the top team had been in Chicago, downtown Chicago, 325 North Wells, for so long, and not out where things were happening. Okay. They were not in touch with the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew that that would not work. And by then I was really getting desperate that they were not going to destroy my career. And
uh-huh.
so I insisted that I'd have the responsibility for the whole marketing group, as well as the entire breeding thing. Before uh-huh. that, I just had the Holstein project testing program. And then we negotiated a bit, and we said, well, that's a lot. So Dave Bartlett actually took responsibility for the international part, because he'd helped found that way back, and that lightened the load a bit for me. And in essence, Phil's had 2 years to retirement, and essentially there was a lot of box put around him, and he was president in name only.
Mm-hmm.
And his assignment from Rock was to find a buyer for ABS. And I was assigned to run ABS. And so that's when then I put into operation the five things I'd outlined a year before. And we started up
and
from there.
Where did, are those five things in here,
no,
or are those in the letter that you don't have?
I'd
love to get those five things.
I will go home and get those for you. I didn't think about that. I was just thinking about how to explain to you the project testing, but I'll get those for you.
Yeah.
But I don't want to hurt Phil. That's what I want you to be sure to edit. So I don't want Phil to be hurt by anything that might come out. But you need to know quite how it happened.
Yeah.
And that's what happened. And so that's when I became responsible for, and I put into practice those changes in the marketing area and the advertising area and the distribution
mm-hmm.
area. You see, even though they had frozen semen from 1956 and 58, you had it nationwide? And before that,
some
before
material
that,
on
the trucks went out in routes from the different places. And what's the guy's name down there?
Conrad.
He was so stuck on that system, I guess, that even though they had the routes and the bulls assigned to the routes months in advance, and even after they had frozen semen, they still did that. They never took advantage of what frozen semen did for them. And so the customers were out there. If somebody wanted a different bull than was on this route, he caught hell, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You weren't supposed to ask for something because this dictatorial idea and Bud fit right into that mold. We're going to give you what we think you should have.
Well, really what happened, what he was, his old-fashioned thinking was, even in the days of fresh semen, Brock had the five bulls.
Yeah.
They moved bulls around
yeah.
because they were concerned about inbreeding.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And even when frozen semen came on and there was only two bulls that's left, Carmel and here, they still would only designate certain
same.
Areas for certain bulls.
Same bulls.
Yeah.
Because of this inbreeding.
Yeah.
And that was one.